Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Long Shots. And today, again, we are going to get back into our guest role. Last week was pretty special, Sharad, wasn't it?
Yeah, we deviated from our status quo and explored new territories.
Yeah, I'm sure today's guest will also have a lot of interesting things to say on that. I think we are kind of done with the JNU, CAA stuff.
Now. Politics is in the backseat now.
Politics is in the backseat. And today's guest is extremely special. He's my senior from IIT Kharagpur. His name is Umang Jain. He is an EdTech entrepreneur and has been in that domain for the past 9 odd years, right?
Yeah, 9 would be fair.
And so Umang did his bachelor's degree from IIT Kharagpur in computer science and master's as well. And after that, he kind of stayed away, I think, after a year or something, he ventured into the educational domain. Some overlapping things also happened while he was at IIT. But before we kind of get into those details, in terms of where Umang is right now, he is the co-founder of StudyPad, right? Which is educational content / technology company. Their flagship app is called Splash Math. Now it's called Splash Learn. And it's pretty interesting how your journey started, right?
It is, yes.
In terms of, I know there was a kind of, it kind of started when you were in IIT itself. Right.
For me, a little later than that. So first of all, thank you guys for having me here. It feels like I've arrived. It's like coming on coffee with Karan.
Great.
There is now, coffee as well here.
There is
no
Karan.
Well,
there's
coffee, no Karan.
No, I prefer you over him.
Right.
Yeah, so I said, as I was saying, for me, it was a little different than my other co-founders. I worked for a tech company in Bangalore for a year.
Mm.
But our previous company, Intino, started in Kharagpur during our fourth year. And then sort of I worked for a year for a tech company and came back to Intino, to coming back home in a way.
Right.
Intino was, the idea then was to create sort of a social LMS, kind of what Edmodo is today.
Hmm.
The genesis was, we figured that, not that the teaching, the level of teaching in IIT was great, but at least we had access to decent course material. The courses itself were nicely designed.
So when you say LMS, like how does it typically work?
Okay, so LMS is a learning management system. The two sides of the coins are teachers and learners.
Right.
And all the engagement that happens between them. So for example, if a teacher teaches something, he can upload all the course material online on that LMS.
Right.
Kids can do assignment there, right? From submitting papers to in fact coding assignments as well, right? So we wanted to start with an LMS, but the idea was if other colleges in India have access to all the course material and the content that we have at IITs.
Hmm.
For example, let's say you're a guy studying in, let's say, Muzaffarpur Institute of Technology, for that matter. And you could enroll in a course happening at IIT Kharagpur, run by a teacher who is definitely more established and more of an expert in that content matter.
Right.
And you could do all the assignments. And
so it was not just for internal consumption. You actually wanted to like create a platform for...
Sure. That was the idea, to open it up eventually.
Right.
The way we decided to do it was get a lot of colleges on board and then sort of leverage the network around it. Right. And of course, IIT Kharagpur were the first guinea pigs for us.
Sure.
And it ran pretty well in IIT Kharagpur. At one point of time, we had mid-semester exams happening on our system as well.
Okay.
Oh, really? While you were there?
No, after just we after, got out. Okay. Just after we got out. Right.
That's a good sense of validation then.
True. And that in itself is an interesting story.
Yeah.
The first time it happened, we were in our office in Gurgaon, home office in Gurgaon, and we had a power outage.
Right.
And we were worried because that sort of concurrent load we hadn't experienced so far. So we were sort of running around, going to friends' places and figuring out, okay, how do we keep a tab on what is happening? But it ran pretty well.
Right.
It ran pretty smoothly. Then we started to sort of try and sell it to other colleges in India. And then there we hit a roadblock. So in terms of what we're trying to do, they had different sorts of problems, right? So for example, one sort of leader in the college told us, the teachers don't know how to teach. They're not interested in teaching. I have other administrative problems to take care of. This sitting on top of it is just not feasible.
Right.
But why don't you make an ERP or a fee management system for me? I'd be interested in taking that. So from there, because we needed to earn money as well, it sort of devolved into or degenerated into more of a ERP and fee management solution for these colleges. The LMS part was there, but it wasn't used in its full capacity in all the institutes.
Right.
Right. IIT was still going strong. We also went into coaching classes in schools selling.
But the biggest kind of roadblock was inertia, institutional inertia, you mean?
Institutional inertia, as well as the sales cycle itself was very long, right? You pitch to like deans and principals, and but the decision maker is somebody else who shall have the money.
Right.
We also had experiences where we did sell, it was used, and then recovery of the money itself was a problem.
So like just to get a timeline of this, this is around like what, 2009-10
exactly. Right. So not 10 even, 2008-9.
So it was anyways kind of before the era where, you know, I guess smart learning systems or, you know, kind of the blend of tech.
True. And yeah, so it was in that era where a web application was synonymous with a website, right?
Yeah. Mm.
So you would hear things like, all right, you have a website and Papu in the street, next street can make it for $1,000.
Right.
So yeah, we were in that kind of an era.
Right.
And the general sense for us was it's kind of hard to sell technology per se to these colleges.
Right.
It has to be more than that. They were like, okay, do you have content? Do you have video lectures? Do you have stuff like that?
Right.
So we did that till late 2009 and early 2010. And then we started thinking that this is not what we intended to do. The essential idea was to empower learners, and that is not happening at all. And then we started thinking of sort of letting that go and moving on to something that would be closer to what we intended to do. And that was the genesis of Splash Math.
So, but I mean, when you say genesis of Splash Math, it seems pretty evident that there was a lot of learning which had happened in an year or 2 years for the build-up. Because in terms of the way you have kind of, like just for the benefit of the listeners, I guess Splash Math is kind of math-focused, it's US-focused, and like US K-12 focused,
right?
So the target market positioning was fairly precise. Right. And I would say quite atypical for an Indian startup. Right.
I would agree, yeah. So, you are absolutely right. So, we did learn a lot from that. One is, before you start creating something, get a hang of what the market actually needs and what would actually sell.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We had a sense that let's create some content, right? iPads had just come out.
Right.
And in the US, they were touted as the thing that will revolutionize education, right?
Mm-hmm.
The federal government was giving grants to schools to buy iPads and buy applications for it. So, then the initial idea was to create something fancy like a science app.
Right.
You could do experiments and like fancy animations happening on the iPad.
Right.
But again, as I said, we had learned. So when we sort of tested out the waters there, we figured what would sell is math and English.
Okay. But this was like when you were looking at the LMS framework. At that time, the content was pretty much coming from the faculty or from the institute. But now you're kind of taking charge of the content yourself.
Right. True. And that is also because we... of the nature of the product that we were trying to build, right? So when you're thinking of making an app, so generally app creators were publishers then. You do not have a lot of platforms, right?
Mm.
So the idea was to create an app where parent or a student can get access to quality learning experience.
Mm.
And I think I was saying, yeah, we did sort of decide to do the content ourselves.
Right.
Math was because we figured math and English would sell. Math seemed more accessible to us as creators.
Yeah, makes sense.
So we said, okay, let's do math. And I think we started development sometime in October. We came out with the first app, which was a grade 3 math app in April of 2011. So then we were still in sort of an experimentation mode then. We'll see what happens. Mm. Right? Let's put it out there. We'll see what happens. And it was a paid app. So another sort of ballsy move that we did was most applications were around 99 cents to $1.99. And we said, yeah, we have created so much content, right? The app covers all of grade 3. So let's charge it like $9.99. So let's say we'll ask $10 for it, like one-time purchase. And did start selling. Another angle that happened we did not anticipate was schools were buying in bulk. So what they get from Apple is a volume purchase discount. So they purchase more than 20 copies, they get a discount. So that started happening. And then we said, okay, this seems like working. Let's create content for more grades. Right? So then we sort of eventually became K-5. In terms of the business model itself, we started with a single one-time purchase for an app.
Right.
Then we had $10 for a grade. And then slowly we moved towards a subscription model. And now it's like $10 a month and you get access to all the content.
You're at par with Netflix pricing now.
Yeah, kind of.
That's pretty interesting.
Much more productive though.
Exactly.
I guess for the end user, hopefully.
You need to buy this app in the long run to afford a Netflix app. Let's put it that way.
That's nicely put. I think, can I use that somewhere?
Sure. I mean, There's nothing proprietary on this podcast.
Got it.
And
what is pretty interesting and pretty cool as well is why US? Why was it, you know, the sort of narrative? I'm sure in 08 also that was like, oh, India has a lot more people and this is sort of a retail product. Like, I mean, sure, you got into bulk subscriptions, but typically like home turf, home advantage, you guys are native, you probably see some competitive advantage. Why sort of US? Like, was it just the app potential was higher up there, faster? Or?
App potential and plus US is an early adopter market, right?
Okay.
So back then, if I try to remember also, I don't see a lot of parents at home, especially using digital products at all.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think it seemed feasible at all at that point of time.
Yeah.
Two, because the idea was to sell and earn money and therefore grow on basis of that. We wanted to go to a market that is more willing to pay at that point.
Makes sense, yeah.
Right? If I'm not wrong, Android wasn't there back then, right?
Yeah, probably.
In 2010. Or probably just starting to pick up.
Yeah,
areas, right?
Yeah.
And even then, monetization on Android was a big problem, especially in developing markets. Right,
right, yeah. So, and sort of logically from that logic, were you targeting other English-speaking Western economies? Sort of, is that how growth, you know, how do you think about growth in terms of geography?
Right, so already if I see right now, primary market is the US, but
yeah,
we do get sizable traction from UK, Singapore, Australia and Canada.
Okay.
We are going to do more sort of concentrated efforts on marketing, getting to these markets this year. UK and Mexico is next in the line for us.
Right.
Mexico, because in US also 30% of the students are Hispanic, right?
Right.
So we already have a Spanish language support in our apps.
Okay.
So Mexico seems like an easier bet at this point. So UK and Mexico are the countries that we are going to go next to.
But I mean, how did you navigate the curriculum framework? Like, I mean, in the Indian context, I think that's fairly slippery slope to take. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of approvals are required in terms of what is visible to the end user. Like, how does that entire ecosystem look in the US?
It does not actually. If you're a consumer product, you don't actually need to get through a lot of approvals at all.
Right.
Right. If you want to sell to schools, you don't need approvals, but they do demand a certain level of trustworthiness from you. So, for example, they would ask, have you done efficacy studies?
Right.
Which shows that your product actually works.
Right.
We did get to that. We did an efficacy study. In fact, two. One was a 8-week pilot study and then we did a year-long study, which sort of showed that our product works well, especially for medium to lower ability students. It did not work as well for a higher ability student, which made sense because it was primarily a supplemental practice program. So for US, efficacy study is a must if you're trying to sell to schools.
Right.
Otherwise, for a consumer market, you don't need a lot.
So, I mean, but you, like, obviously in the beginning when you went live, that was more of serendipity that a lot of schools were actually buying it in bulk. But ultimately, you did go towards schools in a structured manner, right? And obviously, the approach must have been adjusted.
Right. So, yeah, so I sort of skipped a lot of timelines there. Yeah.
Right.
So, after schools organically were purchasing our apps, then we said, okay, if schools are anyway using our apps, we need to give them a proper dashboard and a portal, like on the administrative side,
right,
and empower the teachers more.
Right.
So then we built out a school product, which has a school administrator dashboard, a teacher dashboard,
right,
where they can do class management, roster management, assignments, tracking reports, so on and so forth. And that is when we also went live with a web application, because a lot of schools, not every school had iPads, but a lot of schools did have Chromebooks. So that is how, where we are right now. So we have a web application and an iOS application. In terms of selling, we sort of took a bottom-up approach to sell to schools, right? The typical model was we would offer 3 pilots to teachers, 2-3 month pilots. And once we see enough traction from teachers in a school, let's say you have X number of teachers in a school, then we would approach the decision maker saying, okay, these teachers are already using the product. They are already finding value in it. Why don't you get a premium offering? The pilot is about to expire. So we sort of took that approach to sell to schools, which kind of worked well.
But I mean, how does the entire value chain works, right? In terms of, there are so many models in edtech, right?
Right.
There are companies which focus only on testing. There are companies which focus purely on content.
Right.
Where do you see, like, I know that content proposition is very heavy
for you. Right.
Right. But I mean, that also requires, I mean, that's a kind of capital intensive activity. It has to be thoughtful. It takes time. I'm sure you must be having like a lot of design guys working all the time, updating stuff.
Right.
But is that the like a core which has been identified and I mean it has been identified, but that's something that you want to take forward all the way, or there are some other angles also which you're thinking of?
So if I see how sort of technology can help in education, right? One is what is being taught, how it is being taught, and then the problem of distribution and access. So let's say someone like Khan Academy has solved a distribution and access problem. So you get a lot of people across the world get access to free, decent quality material. Right.
Sure.
Then the part of what and how it is being taught. With any sort of digital revolution in any industry, the first step would be digitization of what you already have. So that is already happening. That is mostly what is happening, right? But once you think of iPad or a digital medium as a primary learning platform, then you'll have to reinvent the pedagogical models themselves, right? So what we're working in classrooms, the kind of teaching methods that were used in classrooms may not be the best methods for a digital medium. And anyways, if you're just copying that, what is the value that the digital medium is adding anyways?
Hmm.
So if you guys indulge with me, I'll go a little deeper into sort of the our standpoint. So it boils down to the difference between active and passive learning. If you think about how you learned at school versus how you learn now, right? In school, you were expected to learn because your teacher was telling something. So the model is there is an expert who knows the subject matter, and then that subject matter or knowledge is being transferred to you, right? And you are passive receivers of that information. How you learn now typically is learn yourself, right? A lot of our learning in professional life happens by learning on the job while you're doing it. Or you take charge of your learning, right? You don't expect someone to tell you what is happening. So that is the difference between passive and active learning, right? So there is enough research that shows that that is not how the human mind works. All the decades of cognitive research tells us that the passive mode is not the best way to learn.
Right.
It may give you higher test scores if you teach to the test, but in terms of long-term retention and long-term learning, it's not the best way. Also, how you learn is also giving you a learning process. Let's say if you learn a certain way all through your school life, right? You sit in a classroom, somebody is telling you stuff and you're just listening to it. That becomes your de facto learning process. You stop taking things in your own hand and trying to learn yourself. So that to me is the biggest problem. That is what we are trying to solve. That is why if you see our program, there are no videos.
Okay. Right?
So because what are videos? They are an extension of the classroom model. Instead of a class teacher being physically here, there is a guide explaining things to you on a video.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing, right? You're still receiving information passively. And therefore, we have gone to a game-based learning model where the expectation is you play games and through that interaction, you learn the subject matter. Of course, that's a difficult problem to solve. Mm-hmm. So one typical problem that we face is the problem of transference. So let's say we design a game to teach you something. You play through the game, done. Are you able to transfer that knowledge out of the game
into
some other context?
Application.
So the games have to be designed in that way where they lead themselves to enable transference.
Right.
That transference dilemma is there even in other learning formats, right? Even from a textbook examination. I mean, we used to always think, I mean, calculating height of a tree and then trigonometry.
Right.
Where are we going to? Will we be able to do that in real life if you're an engineer?
Right.
So that transferring of learning into actual work, that's across formats, right?
Right. So I'll give you an example of a slightly tangential example.
Yeah.
So imagine that you are watching a mainstream movie versus an RT movie.
Okay. Okay.
In a mainstream movie, things are being spoon-fed to you.
Okay.
So it's easy to take that out of the theater. Right?
Yeah.
I know what this is what happened.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You won't remember it.
Yeah.
Because it was like blah.
Yeah.
Right? Versus when you see an RT movie, you're trying to find meanings. And the meaning that you find stays with you for a long time.
Yeah.
Now, it's kind of that. But the problem with education is I can't afford some people to draw meaning out of the art movie and some people don't draw the meaning.
That's
right? You have to enable everyone to draw that meaning.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting.
So the experience has to be rich, the learning has to be deep, but it has to be for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So that essentially is the problem of transference.
But I mean, nice movie metaphor. I remember, who was it? Richard Linklater and David Finch. Those are among their favorites. So obviously the movie metaphor comes out. And but I mean, it's you know, there are two things that kind of struck my mind. One was the point on the pedagogy point,
right?
Because I mean, I had a very funny experience once. I went to if you recall, like when I'd you know, when I was back to India, education was also a space that I was looking at.
I remember,
And then I went to a couple of schools who have like quote unquote smart learning systems in Delhi. One of them had like, I think it was a Tata Smart Edge or something.
Right.
And the biggest thing that was happening was that they had kind of put fixed quotas for the teachers to actually use that system.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a person who was there on the premises who would, you know, like make sure that the maintenance and servicing of the whatever is being done on time. And right. you're nodding because you're obviously very familiar with that game. So, but you know, it was like a very plug and play approach from the teacher's side.
Right.
Like they were using it just for the heck of using it. I don't think they were applying. So that pedagogy point does go a far way in terms of, it's not just about the medium, it's also about how meaningful that medium is for the end point. But on the second side, you know, on the active versus passive point, I agree with you, but don't you think that when it comes to solving education at scale,
right,
by design, it tends to become passive because you just need to have a standardized offering? I mean, I think that's pretty much our school, you know, kind of experience, right? So how do you kind of crack, like, how do you have an active approach at scale?
Right. So, see, one thing that technology will help you do is personalized learning, right? So, that is one problem in a classroom setting, is the teacher does not have enough time or at times data to even know what would work for different kind of students.
Right.
So, how I see it is, if you have an app or a device in front of every kid, then the program adapts to what the kid needs at that point, right? So, if I'm not wrong, that is the question you're asking, is how do I get
that is probably possible in a market like the US where everyone has an iPad, right? But if you look at, I mean, more developing or emerging markets where device access itself becomes an issue,
right,
that technological intervention is still a bit of a distance away.
It is, but okay, so in terms of digital penetration itself, right, smartphone penetration in India is pretty decent,
right?
So I agree, for a program like ours, it's difficult for us to get to every person. We have to assume that the person has an access to smartphone, right? So I don't have a solution to that right now.
And internet?
And internet, not while playing the app.
Okay.
So our app works offline. You just need to download it once.
Right.
So now, what I'm just thinking of, what are the solutions, right? One is to have more empowered, more trained teachers, right? So for us, the standpoint is not that teachers will become obsolete at all. But if you see, who is driving the pedagogical innovation, right? If you look at the research, there is so much research available, and there is so much gulf between research and practice, both in terms of what is happening in the classroom and also happening on educational products. So products like ours will also bridge that gap, right? So while our innovation right now is for an app that is available to, let's say, urban kids only,
right?
But what we learn and what we make from that, I believe that can be applied to a wider sort of scale as well. Maybe that percolates into offline classroom teaching also. So, but that's a little bit into the future.
Right.
At this point, our focus mainly is on, for the audience that we can reach to, what is the best that we can do.
Since, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, creating unique, interesting content is very central to your proposition, right?
Right.
How do you sort of go about that process of creating content where you have to worry about so many things? Like, you probably, I don't know, if is child addiction to that games also a worry, because that also can, you know, create some negative impact. How do you create that curriculum? And then it has to be refreshed, I guess, for every, and what is the sort of, how do you go about it? Like, do you have like internal creative guys who are focused on sort of child psychology? Is that how it works generally?
Right. So I think there are two parts to it.
Sure.
So one is how we build content. Right now, we have an in-house team of curriculum experts,
okay,
game designers, artists, and developers. Those are the sort of people that create the content.
Mm-hmm.
For everything that we create, for example, let's say you pick up one learning objective. Let's say how to add fractions, right? There'll be like deep research into that. What's the research available? What's the best methodologies? Have there been studies that this process is better, right? Then we try to come up with our own process.
Okay.
Our own model. That is very important, because almost all the research that has happened in a non-digital setting,
right?
So how does our app add value to it? What kind of learning models can we build? So that is how we approach a problem. Once we arrive at a model, we quickly try to playtest it.
Yeah.
With kids, right? We get kids to our office quite often and see how they are reacting to it. And then from that, then there's a process of sort of having a nice narrative around it, making like nice visuals and making it into like a decent game, right? That's the general process. The other interesting point that you raised is the whole ethical part of it, about responsible use of digital medium as well as addiction. That is a topic that quite keenly debated in our teams as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, there was a person in our team who wanted to submit a paper in one of the conferences on how to design non-addictive engaging games.
Okay.
So what he was trying to do is, he was trying to list down all the models that typical games use for addiction. And he says, what if you don't use any of them? Can you still make engaging content? Secondly, what do we expect out of a product? I don't expect kids to spend 2-3 hour sessions on our product every day. We don't even encourage that.
Yeah.
Our learning model is you get 4 cards every day that you can finish in 20 minutes. So for us, a successful usage is you come on the app, play for 20-30 minutes every day, but you do it repeatedly.
But it's like not in classroom. It can be anytime.
It can be anytime.
Okay.
Yes. So classrooms, in fact, the problem is even lesser because unfortunately, classrooms don't have enough time anyways. So they'll earmark, let's say, 2-3 hours a week for something like Splash Math, and they'll have dedicated time for it. So there, the problem of capping the usage is easier. It becomes a problem at home. And as Sharad said, especially if your content is very engaging and addictive. So one... Right. So one is trying to not use the standard tropes that game use, right? Mm-hmm. Which are essentially gambling psychology and gambling mechanics.
Sure, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Try not to use that. Two, we also try to design games in a way so you burn through the content. So for example, if a game is around, let's say, how to add fractions, mm-hmm. as soon as you learn how to add fractions, the game is done.
Okay, fair enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Versus there are other stuff. For example, if you're learning how to, you're mastering math facts, like one digit addition, that takes a long time. That game would be longer, but we will try to create devices within the game which will restrict your usage on that day.
Yeah.
So this is a problem. Let's say YouTube Kids also tried to solve in a very interesting way, right?
Yeah.
They had a character that sleeps after a while.
Mm.
So we have to do stuff like that. But we are aware of that responsibility, right? As a parent, I appreciate that even more.
Yeah.
And we definitely want parents to use it in a very ethical way, right? And limited use every day. And in fact, from an academic point of view also, shorter practice sessions, more regular but shorter practice sessions anyway deliver better results than crammed practice sessions.
Right.
Yeah.
But who's kind of like in your... Do parents drive the usage? Do teachers drive? Is it something which goes straight bottom up?
Okay. So typically parents and teachers drive it, right? So what happens with students typically is if the program is not very repulsive at the beginning, they'll be happy to try it, right? Then your retention depends on how engaging it is, what is their experience with it. Because parents are the people who will buy, so therefore the usage is typically, that is where it starts, right?
Mm.
The parent will try and go online and search for something for a particular need. Maybe the child is lagging behind in a particular concept at school. Maybe the child is already ahead of the curve and the parent wants to maintain that advantage, right? Or it's about general practice, right? I want my kid to do better at school, that kind of thing. So that is how they land up at Splash Math, and then it goes into the hand of the student, and then the retention depends on the student completely, right? At least for US parents, they are very quick to discard an app if the child says, I don't like it, right? So we do receive some feedback like, oh, we liked it in the beginning, it did work, but now my child is kind of bored with it.
But that's like the B2C route, right?
That's the B2C route.
Like, what about like when you go through schools?
Okay, so schools, the driver is typically teachers, and there you have to make it really easy for teachers to use it, because the most important and valuable currency for a teacher is time. Apart from teaching, they have a bunch of administrative tasks to do, paper correction and sort of planning, lesson plans and all that.
Right.
So if it is really easy for teachers to use and it fits to their curriculum, they'll be happy to use it. But you have to remove all obstructions. So all tech issues you have to remove, all time taking flows you have to remove. And then, of course, when you're getting a teacher to adopt a program, you'll have to go through do proper due diligence, right?
Mm.
So they'll ask questions, they'll sort of run through the program, understand what is happening. I like this, I don't like this.
Mm.
If you are going through a school route, the school administrator will do those checks anyways. And nowadays, they have all the proper contract. They take security very seriously.
Right.
So you have to make sure all that is happening. The usage is typically driven by teachers. But as I said, that students have to like it for them to continue using it.
Yeah, yeah.
But are they like trained? Is there some sort of a training module which you guys drive?
There is. So there are two parts to the training. One is you have to make the program really easy to use.
Yeah.
And two, once they get onboarded, we have like a guide sort of. Sometimes we also sell sort of professional development services to schools where they need sort of more hands-on training for teachers on how to use Splash Math.
So the idea being that, you know, once a teacher has been onboarded, it depends on, it's mandatory for that teacher to include it within the work plan, or it's something that if he or she feels of utility in terms of, you know, touching a specific area of the lesson, how does it exactly work?
Right. So if a school purchases our product, so they will sort of ask teachers to use it, but it's not mandatory.
Yeah.
So if it does not work for a teacher, the teacher won't use it.
Right.
So let's say if a school buys it for 500 students and two teachers say, oh, that does not work for us, they might say, okay, the rest of the teachers will use it, but it's not working for these guys.
Right.
That happens. So there, I think it's interesting.
Mm.
Teachers do have a lot of autonomy.
Yeah.
Right, in terms of lesson plans and how to teach also.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. It's also important, right, in a way.
Which is, and it works for us. Yeah. And therefore, a lot of our interest from teachers is also inbound. Right? Mm-hmm. Teachers looking for content to help their students also.
Sort of, we're going to switch a little bit on the business side now and dive into growth strategies and funding and competitors and things like that. So first of all, you know, at a very high level, you know, I mean, people generally think of, you have a very engaging base, be it driven by, as Nikhil asked you, being driven by the teachers or parents, ideally one of those two teachers. So is sort of the way to think forward is, okay, these guys are engaging, they like our content. What else can we sell that demographic? Maybe, you know, what is it that teachers need, like training modules or whatever it is? Is that sort of, you know, way route to go and move towards an enterprise play? Or do you think, you know what, we're really good at producing math content, let's just conquer the world? I mean, let you alluded to Canada, Australia and UK. Is that, you know, how do, and again, these are all questions that you wish to answer or not, that's totally up to you, but sort of how do you think about sort of growth going forward? And
So three levers essentially. One is, we are math and we are coming out with our language arts program in 15 days.
Okay, fair enough.
So now, and therefore the name changed to from Flash Math to Splash Law.
Got it.
Right? UK and Mexico, I already said we plan to do this year, and then we can move higher up. So K-5 and then we can go up to K-12.
Okay.
So those are three levers. We want to be the learning platform which parents sort of identify with as quality content, right? And when we say content, I sort of dislike the term content per se, right?
Okay.
Because content might mean that you have like a bouquet of things, right? Versus a curriculum is a more structured for sort of coming together of content.
Right? Yeah.
And this is happens when we create content also, right? It's not about this game. It's also about what happens in this game, what happens in the next one, and then what happens in the next one.
It fits in the overall.
Right? That's how the curriculum is built. So, yeah, we will build curriculums, right? We have done a math. We are doing pre-K to 2 reading program, as I said. And we don't really want to restrict ourselves to only things that are related to curriculum.
Okay.
Or a mainstream sort of things that are taught in school. The idea is to understand what parents need and what are the things that will help kids do better in life.
So health and fitness, maybe...
Probably health and fitness. Yeah. I think I see financial literacy as a big one.
Nikhil and I couldn't agree with you more because we sort of do some work on that as well. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Coding is picking up in the world probably. Yeah. So these are not things that we have decided on doing.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you things may happen. So one interesting thing that I sort of that intrigues me about education is you're trying to prepare students for a world that you haven't seen. Right?
Correct.
Right. So what happened 10 years later when the kid graduates out of school or college? We don't know that world right now.
Yeah.
So what are the skills that will persist? And I think the skill that will persist is how to learn. Are you great critical thinkers? Are you great problem solvers? And therefore it ties back to our philosophy of active learning also.
That's so interesting.
It's not about what you learn now, but also about what kind of learning process that you acquire now. And if you start to solve problems now, if you start to take interest in your learning, if you start to take charge of your learning, I think that will stay with you for a long time.
Yeah. And in terms of sort of competitors in the, let's say, US space or even in the Indian space, are there any companies that you sort of look up to or, you know, or think that they're
looked down upon
or some interesting things people are doing which you think is fantastic in the space?
Right.
And just, you know, overall, I mean, even competitors can be so helpful at times because the entire ecosystem evolves at a faster pace, right?
Sure, sure.
So what are your views on general landscape?
So, so I would not comment on look up or look down.
Sure, right? That's fine.
But there are interesting things happening, right?
Yeah.
Happening. I think, for example, my friends at PlaySheep who are doing something interesting.
Yeah.
So they are not into proper pedagogy, but they are trying to make learning toys, AR-based learning toys. I think I'm quite fascinated what they are doing.
Interesting.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting area again, like AR and VR. This is a discussion that we have internally.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of a detractor of these modern technologies in a way that...
But I guess in case of PlaySheep, they are taking like a hybrid approach, right? They actually have physical toys which interface with...
Fidgetal, yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's the...
That's the term, fidgetal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool in terms of how it's structured, right? I mean, you're actually engaging, like the child is engaging with the toy.
Yeah.
But there's... obviously some amount of interface through AR.
Are there any characters in your... I'm sorry, but I've not looked at your content of AR. Are there any characters that sort of are becoming popular in terms of the kid demographic? Because that opens up a whole merchandising and licensing revenue line.
It's quite interesting that you asked that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the game-based push, right? So I'll have to tell you a little bit more about the product. When we started out, it was a gamified practice solution, right? And there is a clear distinction between what is gamification and what is game-based learning. Gamification is when you apply game-based constructs to things that are not games.
Mm-hmm.
And game-based learning is you're trying to make applied games for a specific subject matter, right? So we had a gamified practice solution which offered sort of the whole breadth of a curriculum, broken down step-by-step learning,
mm-hmm.
and a happier learning experience for kids.
Yeah.
So now we are taking this push into game-based learning. And the question we are trying to answer is, can games teach? Hopefully, yes. There we are creating a whole world of characters, right? And eventually, we hope that we get to that place. Right now, the whole idea is, so for example, let's say if Mickey Mouse was synonymous with addition, right? The whole world would have been different, I believe.
Right? Yeah.
Mm.
So the idea is, can we do something like that?
Yeah.
Right? The current focus is, of course, to help education and help learning. But of course, we have an eye on what could happen. So let's see what happens.
What do you think about, like, I mean, we haven't spoken a lot about the Indian market.
Right.
I mean, I know that's not probably the first focus area for you. But right. I'm assuming that will be an area that you'll look at maybe in the short term. That being said, like, there are obviously some very specific challenges to the Indian market.
Sure, yeah.
So if you like look at Splash Learn, where do you see yourself fit there? And you know, and the second question is kind of a bit off in terms of when I sometimes, you know, take a step back and, you know, like me and Sharad, we had the kind of opportunity to go abroad.
Right.
So we kind of can compare the way learning was done when we were here and the way learning was done when we were there. I mean, even though it was at a much it was not at a school level.
Sure, sure.
But one of the things that I noticed was, you know, when it comes to like things like soft skills, you know, the entire, you know, idea of like structuring your thoughts and oral communication, I think that's something which often gets lost in translation here. Right? What are your thoughts on that as well? I mean, I know there are quite different buckets of questions. But right. Yeah.
I'll start with the latter question.
Yeah.
I think one area that when I was talking about other things that we can do, SEL or social emotional learning is a big one coming up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of focus on that.
Yeah.
And I believe generally in terms of how we are growing up as kids now,
yeah.
right, sort of in disjointed nuclear families and sort of less human interaction than we had, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And I think we are seeing symptoms of that in adults as well, right?
Mm.
More digital connection, less sort of actual human connection. And I think mental health itself is going to be a big thing, right? And therefore, I think the whole social emotion learning aspect will become big. Now, how can digital help in that is a question that I don't have an answer to yet.
Yeah.
But though I know that there is a, I think there is a UN-led organization, I forget the name, they do conferences every year and they try to make games for change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? For them, SEL is one of a big tracks that they are working on. So I definitely think that there is something very interesting that's going to happen in that space.
Yeah.
Probably we might be able to do something.
That's very interesting. One of our actually common friends, he's a teacher at Heritage who focuses on SEL.
Okay.
And another friend of ours that I know through him, she's an American, and they both sort of focus a lot on SEL. And I think they're going to present a paper in LA on SEL and how to evolve.
Nice.
So we've been trying to get them on the podcast as well, so that turns into a nice segue.
So one thing that our sort of game designers have been trying to incorporate is sort of good habits inside the games itself. So for example, in a game, can you show teamwork? You are learning math, but in terms of peripheral learning, can we sort of push those values as well? So that kind of an SEL track we are doing right now. So we are thinking of doing right now, but as a sort of more distinct effort on it, we'll see.
Yeah.
Come back to the Indian market.
Right.
So, yeah, there'll be challenges. So, one is, I think in terms of general Indian consumers, they are getting used to paying recurring fees for things that they see value in, right?
Mm.
I think Netflix would have, 1-2 million subscribers, Hotstar probably 3.5 million, something
right.
around that.
Right.
And our demographic, anyways, right now is young parents. They would be tech savvy, if not tech savvy, at least well conversant in technology.
Tech conscious.
Right. But one challenge that I see is right now, especially for elementary school, the kind of media that is being consumed is mostly around entertainment. But over time, if parents have to pay for content, I think they will see a shift there. They'll try to seek more value in what the kids are consuming and therefore ask questions around, is my child actually learning anything? And is the efficacy demonstrable at all? In US, I think it's already there. But there's another thing at play in the US is they have standardized tests from grade 3.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole elementary landscape changes a bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think parents will, and that is probably that will happen through players like us, where we sort of lead that education also for parents, that how important are foundational years in terms of building the right foundation, right concepts and like learning processes. That will happen. But I think that will take some shift for them to adopt more sort of valuable solutions over just entertainment. Two, I think we are mostly digital driven in terms of acquisition, right? I think when we come to India, this demographic or urban demographic is something that we can target through that. Otherwise, we'll have to sort of invent on those models also. That's the challenge I see.
But you see India, like you see the premium belt in India is probably...
The first frontier, definitely.
Right.
So, for right now, we have just come out with our Android, the first Android app. Yesterday, it's in early access now.
Right. Okay.
That's our first step towards getting to a market like India, because I think Android is very critical to play here.
Right.
The good thing is that in terms of the curriculum itself, mostly across the world, elementary curriculum kind of looks like the same.
Okay.
Right. In terms of standards.
Yeah.
Right. So what is the kid expected to know? In terms of teaching, it may vary, but the standards are kind of similar. And on the tech level, we have that sort of, what we like to boast about is I can launch a new curriculum for a country in 15 days. Right. That we have sort of modularized our application in that way.
Such an extent.
Right. So those things we can do. The idea is the first frontier is, of course, the urban population we can reach through digital sort of mediums. And then we'll have to invent on how do we go wider.
But like device behavior will be quite different here, right?
Right.
It's more of I don't know, like I assume here the usage is more shared in terms of device ownership.
Right.
How do you kind of look at that?
So I think that's there in US also, right?
Okay.
So for example, the whole boom of families purchasing iPads has sort of plateaued anyways.
Right.
So in terms of our usage also, we see an increasing share of iPhones. And for elementary, we have to assume that the parent's iPhone.
Right? Yeah.
I think the same behavior will happen in India, where the parents will give their phones to the child to use. Right? So I don't think a big challenge there.
But like, is it like a lot of the edtech platforms like also kind of incentivizing or pushing schools to buy devices on behalf of students? Yeah. That kind of becomes a long capital heavy road in its own way, right?
Unless it's an Akash tablet.
Yeah. Okay. So one sort of model that we're trying in the US also is the B2C, B2B2C route.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get to schools and try to get to parents, so schools can have it some content for free and the premium offering can be bought by parents.
Right.
So I think we can try something like that in India when we come here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Two, in some interaction that I have had with schools, they're kind of sick of it. At least few principals have told me that yeah, there are like so many products trying to do the same.
Yeah.
That I'll give it to you. Why don't you display in the parent teacher meeting? Why don't you send email to parents, etc. Right. Those kind of things. But we'll see. So
how do you kind of? I mean, it is a crowded space, right?
Right.
I think in any ways here, like in terms of there's always that price differentiation play that kind of goes very very quickly, right?
Right.
And that becomes the biggest differentiator mode, whatever you might call it. Everybody's doing it. You have a very precise focus on quality,
right?
And you kind of select your battles that
right.
way. That's something that you want to extrapolate here as well, to whatever extent it can happen.
Right. Two things. One, I think for us, the product is the same. The content is the same.
Yeah.
Right? So even if we are building it for an economy that is willing to pay more, that can discount what the Indian user would pay.
Right.
Two, I think the prices will stabilize pretty soon. Right. There may be a bit of fluctuation initially, then it will sort of stabilize to a point where all the players are there.
Right.
And then it's about a matter of quality and then who delivers the greater value.
Right.
That would happen. What was your earlier question?
No, my question was that when you went to principals,
right,
and they were like, oh, we are sick of products, right? There are too many, so why don't you... So basically, they have too many of the same thing,
right?
Which, and probably the only differentiator there would be some kind of a pricing delta here or there.
Right.
I mean, they don't really find any kind of a... kind of actionable quality there, and I'm assuming price arbitrage in India is probably the first approach which everybody follows.
Probably true. Schools will have to be essential part of the strategy. If our aim is to change how kids learn, we have to go to where actually most of the learning is happening,
right?
So we have to go there. I think, for example, I know for some products that sell here in India, they actually charge more per student than we charge in the US.
Okay.
So while the number of schools who will adopt such sort of programs is lesser, but I don't think money is a problem. A lot of these schools if you look at school fees these days, right? For premium schools, it's quite high. For other schools, they're happy to offload it to parents also, right? I think I've seen that model also where they say, okay, we adopted this program and then you have to pay $100 a month extra for this. So there are different models where we can work on, right? The US model, if that works for us, right? When we have a freemium offering for schools and then a premium offering for parents, the same can be replicated here also, right? I think when I said the principal said they are sick of products, the product has to sell itself there, right?
Yeah.
If they see the, if we go with an aim saying, okay, the primary objective is just to go to parents without delivering actual value to schools, that's a problem, right? If you look to create actual value for schools and while their usage does help them, then I think it's a battle that can be won.
I guess it's also a question of like when, I mean, I guess that is the process then when you are even pitching it to any school,
right?
The idea is, okay, how will it help my students, right? So you must have internally done a lot of studies which kind of demonstrate, you know, improved learning of learning outcomes, and that probably that thesis also applies in a geography like India. The outcome might be slightly different, or the expectation, or the expectation of how much of a delta it will happen might be different, but I guess that entire thesis has to also play here, right?
I'm not very sure about that.
Okay.
Right? So, for example, US ed sector and the school circuit, they are very, very sort of cognizant of efficacy studies and the proof points, right?
Yeah.
India mein problem hai. So, because I don't think any of the products have done any study.
Right.
And the schools are not asking those questions.
Yeah.
Right? So, in terms of, their mindset is generally not data-driven.
So, what are they being sold on then?
Pretentious quality.
Probably.
Right.
Yeah, but right. That will take, it is changing though, but you're right, we are probably 20-25 years behind in terms of how much of strictness there is around it.
And I'm sure, I'm not saying that schools are not trying to see value in it, right? But for them, the actual process of telling them the value may be different. So maybe just showing them an efficacy study that was done in the US might not work because they're not used to seeing that, right? Maybe a different approach would work, right? Probably, let's say if I do an assessment for them for free, take this assessment and we'll give you a nice report and see whether there's actual value or not.
Right? Because, you know, when you said that, like, often people don't ask the right questions, it's very interesting because, one of my cousins, like, she was in a, like, I think it was Heritage. I don't think it was the same Heritage. It was some other Heritage, whatever, in a different city. And they had Educom systems, right? And for almost 6 years, the fee was inflated because of those systems. And obviously, there was that entire gap of just getting translated from a pedagogy perspective and teachers not using it.
Right.
And then, obviously, the company itself had its own story.
Right.
But then they kind of just, you know, phased it out. It kind of became like one of those things that, you know, every year we pay X. Let's just renew it.
Right.
So, I guess the initial customer acquisition cost must have been humongous.
Right.
But after it was acquired, that entire institutional inertia of asking the right questions kind of got lost in translation, right?
Right.
And that did not really lead to a great outcome in the end.
True. But so, for example, let's say if as a product we are confident of the value that we deliver, right? So it's our job to also make the efficacy demonstrable.
Yeah, yeah.
So, for example, in our school product we have assessments. So we, and that can act as benchmark assessments.
Right.
So we ask the teachers to take those assessments, let's say once, twice and thrice a year, and chart the growth,
right?
See whether there is actual learning happening, right?
So
because we have done a study, we know that the product works. I think we, a product like ours, will push that mindset also, right? We'll go to schools and say, why don't you ask the right questions? And we will prove to you that this works. And you should hold every other product at the same level. So I think once a mainstream product enters a market, it becomes, I think that conversation will change pretty soon. They will start to ask the right questions.
I mean, kind of also is reflective of how the product is structured, like, in the sense that if suppose on the dashboard, if I give a test and after every 3 months, like a thing pops out on its own saying that this is the curve,
right?
That vital piece of information, like I'm not asking anyone to kind of input that data somewhere and actually do an analysis. It's through the product itself that it's coming out.
Right.
That itself becomes a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of, you know, reinforcing the quality proposition at bay.
True, absolutely. And I think as assessment players themselves increase, right? So I think there are people are, that market is also sort of, I think, maturing, where people are selling assessments.
Right.
So once assessments are being sold, schools will also get into the habit of tracking progress and not waiting for your end of year school results or unit test to actually assess what is happening.
Right.
And anyways, the trend is to move away from exams, right, in elementary school. So you have this continuous and comprehensive evaluation that is happening. So then sort of this, here the digital remediation will play a big role. So not just product like ours, which is a learning product, but also assessment products.
Interesting.
In terms of sort of competition, I again sort of come back to it. I find that subject very interesting. But what about, so there are some big companies, content companies, right, who already have a character which is well known to everyone. Like, I know kid, like Peppa Pig is very popular among kids. There's some, are you seeing them sort of vertically move into this education space, or that is a threat, or is that something that you think, you know, they're focused on entertainment content entirely,
right?
So it's sort of not really up their alley.
Right. So I would not say up their alley. So what I would say is I segregate the edtech products into two segments.
Yeah.
One is education led and two is entertainment with a dash of education.
Okay.
And
your parents in, yeah,
right. So I think I sort of put them in that bucket. The idea for them is still to drive entertainment, but because there is an education play, it sort of makes it easier for parents to not feel that guilty about letting their kids
it's
a sweetener, right? So I see it at that level, and I think it's about what you're trying to do as a company and DNA also, right?
Yeah.
And we have put a lot of hard work and research into
curriculum,
sort of curriculum development, and I think we'll definitely have an edge there to follow them.
And is your child a user?
Not yet, because he's three. So I don't have a product for him yet. But there are some modules in our kindergarten product that he can use now.
Yeah.
Right. So he's a part of the playtesting sessions.
Yeah, of course. Of course he is.
Right.
So and he's quite excited by it. So there is a character called Ulzu that we have in one of our games. Right.
Okay.
It's a big character. Right. Which is the answer
to
your question. And that is the conversation we have. So every Saturday, like today is the day we go to office and play in a Mizu game.
Right. Yeah, nice. Yeah.
Right. And let's talk about fundraising.
All right.
That's all. So that's always a fun thing to chat about.
We haven't done a lot of that. So
no, but I mean, you have. But I think you guys kind of were not chasing it, right? Took your time in terms of seeing when the fit happens, and then it happened.
Right.
But like, I'm kind of just curious, like when you position yourself to a third party investor, like you're a content company, you're a tech company, you're a bit of both, right? I mean, that kind of, I'm sure you must have been in a lot of meetings where you suddenly got like pigeonholed at, oh, like you do content, and that's like a very, we do a lot of content. So we also kind of hear those conversations. So what was your experience like?
So in the meetings I have been, I think the investors have been very happy to hear about the education side of it,
right,
like go into depths of it and why we are doing and how we are doing what we are doing. So my experience has been generally good.
Right.
Of course, there is one sort of level of skepticism, which is because it is a crowded market, right? US is a very crowded market when it comes to K-12 education. India, probably K-5 is a little thin right now, but it's also heating up, right? So there is a level of skepticism, and there is the challenge to sort of highlight and show your differentiator and why are you different.
Yeah.
That challenge is there. But that differentiator for us is in building engaging and effective learning content. So we sort of try to take the conversation there. So I don't think we have been pigeonholed as a content company as such.
Right.
Of course, there'll be questions like, why can't anyone else make that content?
Yeah.
And that is sort of some defense they have to put to it. And finally, they have to see value and sort of understand the value you're creating, understand the process of content creation. Right? And then they understand the focus on delivering content that is effective,
right,
and making sure that the learning is happening. And I don't think a lot of companies have that focus anyways.
But what worries you? Or does anything worry you?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let me think. So imagine you are on a train.
Yeah.
Right. And there's this fancy place that you're about to reach.
Yeah.
Right. Then you're restless to get there as soon as you can.
Yeah.
So that is my worry, restlessness, or sort of impatience.
Right.
That, so I know the value we can create, right? Mm-hmm. I have seen this space for long. I've talked to teachers, I've seen schools, I've seen all sort of education programs, I've seen the research.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the problem, I see the solution, I see the gap, but it takes time to get there.
Yeah.
Right. So that time,
uncertainty,
is causes rest.
Anxiety.
The anxiety and the restlessness of me. So get there faster. How can we get there faster?
Right.
So I don't know, it's chill. Having fun.
That was a very I would say optimistic.
It's not a worry at all. It's excitement.
Not at all. Yeah, it's excitement. It's not worry.
What's the point of worrying anyway?
Yeah. True. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But I mean, like you mentioned research.
Right.
I mean, I just have a generally you hear that a lot nowadays. Kids don't read.
Right.
Nowadays, kids don't engage. Nowadays, you know, kids don't. You don't see kids outside playing.
Right.
right? I mean, I don't know how much I was playing, but I mean, right. I mean, you keep on hearing that, and I often feel that it's also about, you know, it's not just about, like, just because you're not reading a physical book, that doesn't mean that you're not reading.
Right.
There are lots of other ways to engage and consume content.
Right.
What's your take on, like, you must have seen a lot of data on that, I'm sure, right? How do you, and you have a kid yourself,
right.
So you are well positioned to answer that question. Have things really changed a lot fundamentally in terms of, for the worse, for the better?
Some things for the worse, some things for the better. So for example, for my kid, right? So I can compare his childhood to my childhood, right?
Yeah.
And we are in different places geographically.
I
grew up in a very small town. He is growing up in a city.
Mm.
For us, the access to playing spaces was sort of, it was never a problem, right?
Yeah.
It was a problem of plenty. Where do we play today?
Yeah.
I think that is a problem.
Mm. Right?
So in our society, we had a park and like a football ground, and then they have made a school on it and no one is using it. There's a building lying there for 3 years.
Mm.
Those kind of things do worry me.
Yeah.
It's getting harder for them to access open spaces.
Right.
You drive to a park and you do that sort of stuff.
The air doesn't help either.
That's a problem too.
Yeah.
And also interaction with other kids.
Okay.
Right. And of course, there is daycare and there is school.
Mm.
Right. Apart from that, growing up with kids. We sort of grew up with kids. Right?
Mm.
So we were never at home after school. At somebody's home, playing cricket, doing something. So that is yet to be seen. Right. He's still young to sort of pass a comment on that.
Mm.
But I do see that problem. On the other hand, I think as parents, we know a lot more.
Okay.
So... than what our parents did, frankly.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
There is, because we know how kids learn, what takes them. We have access to better health. We have access to better healthcare, right? We have access to better tools in terms of education, right? And we have the benefit of hindsight as parents. So I think, generally, I believe every generation is better off.
Right.
The intelligence is improving, the exposure is better and all that is happening.
Yeah, right.
Any generation that is at the cusp of something that is changing dramatically, there is a risk.
Mm.
Right. So for example, digital medium, there has to be moderation and parents have to drive that moderation.
Mm.
Okay. Products have to be responsible, but that's ultimately parents have to drive that level of moderation. We do, and I think a lot of parents that I do, they do as well. I am not a proponent of keeping technology away from kids.
Right.
That is going to happen anyways.
Right.
Right. But responsible uses is good enough. So I'm generally optimistic about how they
work. Like, you keep on hearing, you know, like big tech CEOs in the US, they actually send their kids, especially to schools where there are no access to any devices.
Right.
I mean, that kind of makes the general public slightly wary, you know.
Where is the study that proves that's better?
I don't know. They are doing it, except everybody thinks that, you know, they probably know it more than the other guys, no?
They don't.
They don't.
So I think, so for example, all these like new age school, like art school also.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the overall perception now is great.
Okay.
Right? They decided to do something dramatically different.
Right.
I think rather irresponsibly.
Right.
See, education is a slow-moving industry, and rightly so. Right. Every change is going to impact the child that you're interacting with. You can't just change things like that.
And the repercussions will come 10, 20 years down the line, like you said. Yeah.
And so this is what we say. I tell all my sort of content creators or curriculum experts also that, see, every minute that the child interacts on your system, you're taking that minute away from his daily life.
Correct.
Right. Make sure that there is actual value in it. Right. Don't waste the kid's time. There's no point. So I don't... I think kind of a gimmick also.
I kind of, you know, like the reason why I kind of asked is that, for instance, if I talk to like someone who is like one or two generations above me, right, they will be like, oh, you know, when it came to like, you know, basic arithmetic, you know, doing numbers, when you are like, you know, sitting in the moment, you know, it used to be so quick. Nowadays, you know, everybody has to use like a device or a tool or whatever.
Mm.
You know, they kind of, and like my answer normally is that, you know, if something can be done better on a spreadsheet, right, why kind of, you know, why do you have to kind of, you know, do a mental math exercise? It's just a question. It's like driving a car. If you can kind of, you know, from point A to point B, go quicker in a car. Otherwise, everybody would be walking around. So I just want to know, like, as a edtech entrepreneur, you know, this is kind of pretty center to your overall proposition. What are your, you know, what kind of philosophy do you take there?
So I actually do agree. So for example, there was time where there were human computers or calculators, right?
Mm.
So and then it made sense to do a lot of mental computation, be really quick with it, right?
Right.
Doesn't make sense anymore, right?
Right.
For anything that is super important, you probably go to your phone or a computer and do that computation anyways, right? On the other hand, for example, the idea is to understand why are we doing anything. So let's say if we subject kids to some sort of mental exercises,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Do some mental math.
Yeah.
The idea is not for them to be like Vedic math gurus.
I
can do 399 to 599 like this. That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But if that gives you a certain sort of mental process,
sure,
why not? So again, what they do is not just about the immediate result, but also how it impacts them in terms of the processes that they acquire.
Right.
So I, for example, I'll give you a sort of example. The written method of addition that we used to do, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, right? You don't need to do it anymore. In fact, the US curriculum does not teach it till grade 4.
Which one?
The written method of addition.
Okay. Right?
The vertical method. In India, we're doing it in grade 2. Yeah. They don't do it even at grade 4. Because it doesn't make sense at all, right? If I ask you to add two numbers, that is not the way you'll do it in your head, right? You'll not pick a pen and paper to do it anyways. You'll rather go to your computer or your phone. So kids have to be prepared for the world they are going to live in, not for the world we inhabited.
It also kind of reflects upon like the stereotypes of intelligence, right?
Like, I mean, yeah, so for example, Indian kids are good at math.
I mean, and that's supposed that's supposed to make us smarter, but I mean, it's
is that true? Is there any research that suggests that?
Right. So the last time we sent our kids to PISA test, we are 40th in the world.
Yeah.
So I don't know. After that, we stopped sending them.
Yeah.
So there is no proof that we are better at math at all. So I think there was one of our colleagues who said, why don't we do Vedic math? I said, why would we do Vedic math?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. It's like party tricks.
Current political dispensation would definitely disagree with you. I think they would love some.
Can we edit this part out?
No. I mean, considering our last podcast, I think this was pretty mind touch. All right. I mean, interesting chat here. We kind of we started with like product content. We went into the business side of things. Then we went into parenting, and you know,
this is one of the longer ones we've ever had on this in the series.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
No, that's it's a compliment. It's a good thing. Yeah. No, thanks. Thank you so much for finding the time. I know you had a long car ride from Gurgaon. It's difficult to get hold of you otherwise. So I thought the best way to do it is call you for a podcast. But sure. Jokes aside. And thanks a lot for coming over. And it was a pleasure chatting up.
Hopefully, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun.
Nice. So yeah, I think that's about it for this week, and we'll see you guys shortly. Obviously, feel free to put in your comments on our podcast. Let us know what we can do better. If there are any, you know, guest suggestions, or if someone wants to come over, let us know as well. That would always be a fun proposition to deal with. And
I can certify this is fun.
There you go. So it has been certified from a parent. So yeah. That kind of, you know, gives us added brownie points. So this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran
signing off.